calls between the attackers and phone numbers in Pakistan. The charts included some numbers associated with known ISI officers. They met the Major General who ran ISI's analysis directorate. The exchange unfolded along familiar lines. The ISI General opened with denial and defensive accusations that India was inventing lies about the Mumbai evidence to besmirch Pakistan. "I'm surprised and disappointed that you believe this Indian propaganda," was the thrust of his initial argument. Then the visitors laid out their evidence. The general backed up to a secondary defense. "We will both have to investigate this." Ann Patterson, the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, was also away. Jerry Firestein, her deputy, and the acting CIA station chief soon met Kayani and Pasha. Kayani said that the government of Pakistan had nothing to do with the matter. He denounced India's rush to judgment about the details of the case, and said that, as a former intelligence chief, he would never have suggested that he could offer up an analysis of the events so quickly after they concluded. Yet the evidence made it all but certain that Lashkar had been responsible, and Lashkar was effectively a paramilitary arm of the Pakistani state. It had been officially banned in 2002 under U.S. pressure and had reorganized under a new name, but although some of its ranks had become so radical that they had joined violent jihad against Pakistan, the group remained cooperative with ISI. It had collaborated closely with Directorate S on training and cross-border attacks for more than a decade. Indian counterintelligence files in Kashmir brimmed with transcripts of cross-border communications during violent attacks. Lashkar had tens of thousands of members in Pakistan, and its infrastructure in the country was open and unmolested. Its successor after the ban maintained a large campus just outside Lahore, ran schools and hospitals, and maintained bank accounts as if it were a legitimate non-governmental organization. The sophistication of the Mumbai assault required planning and resources that Lashkar possessed. Pasha arrested Lakhvi, the Lashkar military chief, and interrogated him about the attack's history. The Americans asked for direct access to the prisoner. Pasha held them at bay. Eventually, the FBI and CIA would document that several retired or active ISI officers had planned and funded the Mumbai operation. They learned this primarily through the confessions of David Headley, a Pakistani-American involved in the plot. He was arrested in the United States and cooperated. Born Daoud Gilani in Washington, D.C., he grew up in Pakistan and joined Lashkar after the September 11th attacks. At a mosque, he met Abdur Rahman Hashim Syed, a retired Pakistani major. Syed, who went by Pasha, had once been active with Lashkar, but disagreed with what he regarded as its relatively soft approach to jihad. He regarded Lakhvi as an ISI puppet, and he joined debates among Lashkar cadres about whether it was permissible to assassinate Pervez Musharraf. Lakhvi told them that their loose talk had reached ISI, which was annoyed. Eventually, Pasha joined a more independent jihadi group led by Ilyas Kashmiri, an ambitious radical who operated out of the tribal areas. During this period, the Pakistani cells surveyed diverse targets inside India. Lakhvi plotted an extravagant attack on the Indian military academy at Dehradun. One squad would attack cadets during morning exercises, and a second would go inside and recover the pistol surrendered to India by Pakistan's commanding general at the end of the devastating 1971 war. It was the terrorist equivalent of a fraternity raid, but Lakhvi thought it would thrill ISI. It fell apart when local conspirators were arrested. In 2006, Headley traveled with his friend Pasha to Khyber Agency in the federally administered tribal areas. He was stopped and interrogated by a Pakistani officer who identified himself as Major Ali. Headley explained to Ali that Lashkar had trained him for action. Ali asked for his cell phone number. Several days later, another officer, who described himself as Major Iqbal, telephoned. Headley became Iqbal's espionage agent on behalf of ISI. Iqbal gave Headley a total of about $30,000 for expenses and trained him in intelligence tradecraft, including spotting and assessing people, recognizing Indian military insignia and movements, dead drops and pickup points, and clandestine photography. Under Iqbal's direction, Headley used his American passport to travel to Mumbai 5 times to survey targets by videotape and to mark potential landing zones with GPS equipment. Headley eventually identified an ISI colonel and an ISI brigadier who worked the account out of Muzaffarabad, the capital of the section of Kashmir occupied by Pakistan. Even as it became fully evident that ISI officers had cooked up the Mumbai attack, the scale of its provocation presented a puzzle. Directorate S's strike on the Indian embassy in Kabul the previous summer might be rationalized as a warning or reprisal shot against an Indian government target. The Mumbai attack was a Hollywood-inspired terrorist extravaganza that would delegitimize Pakistan abroad and risked igniting a nuclear war. Who in the Pakistani establishment or in active command at ISI could have thought that was a winning idea? Kayani was clearly responsible for the broad contours of ISI covert policy in Afghanistan and Kashmir, but it was not easy to believe that he would have sat down, ticked through military and political calculations, and ordered an attack of this scale and character. Kayani and Pasha had replaced General Akhtar at Directorate S just weeks before the Mumbai attack. The scale of the covert and militant networks ISI sought to manage or influence was mind-boggling. American intelligence reporting put the total number of armed militants in Pakistan at about 100,000 and estimated that ISI ran 128 different training camps and facilities. London and Washington continued to hopefully regard Pasha as the broom, as British Foreign Secretary David Miliband put it that December, a modernizing leader who would sweep in reform at the spy service. The American hypothesis, too, was that Mumbai offered a perhaps constructive shock to the system Pasha had inherited. Zardari encouraged such thinking. The overreach of the Mumbai attack offered his civilian government a rare opportunity to seize control of ISI and strike at my enemies, he told the Americans. An intelligence study of the Mumbai attack carried out by the United States and Allied services concluded that the cabal of retired officers working with the Lashkar units and Hafez Saeed believed they had been given strategic direction from the top to pressure India. The purpose of such pressure, Indian officials firmly believed, was to undermine their booming economy, which was leading India to separate from Pakistan year by year in wealth and power. The Mumbai attack would make it appear to the world that India was not a rising power, but a fragile state. Yet the retired ISI officers had not cleared the audacious scale of the Mumbai operation with superiors, the analysis concluded. The clearance rules have changed, was the sardonic line CIA and British operations officers used with one another to explain what happens when a semi-authorized covert action goes wrong. That is, actions that might have been authorized if they had succeeded become unauthorized when they don't. ISI may have also sought a perverse sort of credibility through the Mumbai assault to prove to its own restive clients that it was not going soft and that it should not be considered the enemy. After ISI lost control of important sections of its militant clients in 2007, not only were its offices targeted in suicide bombings, its legitimacy was increasingly ridiculed within radical Islamist circles. There was ISI jihad, the dissenters argued, meaning pinprick strikes in Kashmir, and there was the real jihad, carried out by Taliban militias and allies against Western occupation forces in Afghanistan. ISI officers could point to the Mumbai attack as evidence of their credentials. "We are still with you," bolder than ever. A few weeks after the attack, a new CIA station chief arrived in Islamabad. John Bennett had graduated from Harvard University in 1975, served 5 years as a U.S. Marine officer, and then joined the CIA. In between management roles at Langley, he had served 17 years abroad, mainly in Asia and Africa, including several previous tours as station chief. The U.S. Embassy's strategy after Mumbai was to present Pakistan's government with as detailed evidence about the attack as could be released to such a poorly trusted foreign ally. And Patterson and the FBI handed over copious amounts of tearline information, intelligence cleared for sharing with a foreign government, sometimes written in sanitized form below the tearline of a fuller classified cable, about the Pakistani company that had sold the outboard motor used on the dinghy bearing the terrorists to Nariman Point, as well as information from the surviving attacker, Kassab, who was now undergoing interrogation in Indian custody. Bennett presented to ISI dossiers of evidence about the attack that India had distributed to international diplomats. The Americans again sought direct access to Lashkar commanders in ISI custody. Pasha now said the FBI and CIA could submit written questions quietly, and he would see what could be done. Pasha told Bennett that the detainees refused to sign their confessions, leaving ISI to work with Pakistani police to develop an evidentiary trail that would allow prosecution. A familiar ISI rope-a-dope to protect clients had begun. The U.S. Embassy hypothesized that Pakistan was struggling to come to grips with the consequences of an attack that exposed ISI's decades-old policy. Yet the best evidence was that Pakistan sought to minimize the fallout from Mumbai, not reverse ISI policy. As ever, the default American approach remained engagement and hope for change, a hope based on the attraction of new leadership personalities in the Army and at ISI. In the final days of the Bush administration, as the South Asia hands departed, they took with them a darker view, with Mumbai as the last straw in a 7-year journey from counterterrorism partnership to disillusionment. After Mumbai, Elliot Cohen concluded, "I think in some ways we were actually fighting the ISI." Bush wanted to visit Afghanistan one last time. Despite the war's deterioration on his watch, he remained proud of the Taliban's initial defeat and the elections that had brought in Karzai and a diverse parliament. He found it difficult to grasp that the Taliban were rooted in rural Pashtun society. In Bush's mind, the Taliban were merely the promoters of a fanatical, barbaric brand of Islam, characterized by the oppression of women and the denial of the simplest pleasures, singing, clapping, and flying kites. The National Intelligence Estimate of 2008, issued as Bush prepared for his farewell visit, tried to explain the Taliban's comeback as partly the result of its perceived growing legitimacy as an alternative to Karzai's predatory government. In the Oval Office, before Bush departed for his final visit, Peter Lavoie presented these findings. "The Taliban? Legitimate?" Bush asked. "These same guys who are hanging people on soccer fields?" He rejected the conclusion. He could afford to stand firm. The war was no longer his to solve. Flying by Black Hawk helicopter from Bagram to Kabul, Bush detected an acrid smell and realized it was coming from burning tires. Sadly, an Afghan way of keeping warm. After meetings at the palace, Bush and Karzai shook hands and hugged. Bush made one pointed concession to the Afghan president. "About ISI," he told Karzai, "you were right." Chapter 20. The New Big Dogs. Since the 1970s, the Vice President of the United States has lived in a white 19th century home on the grounds of the Naval Observatory, a tree-lined campus on a rise between Massachusetts and Wisconsin avenues. Dick Cheney, who had made a fortune in the oil industry, had furnished the home from his own resources. When he moved out, he took his furniture with him. Joe Biden had been living on a senator's salary for 36 years. He commuted to Washington by train from his family home in Delaware. He had no spare sofas and beds grand enough for such a place when he moved in early in 2009. Navy personnel rummaged around some warehouses and pulled together a loosely coordinated, classical-looking assortment. In its air of improvisation, the house reflected its newest occupant. Biden was 66 years old that winter, still vigorous and handsome, with a full head of silver hair and an uncannily white smile. Obama had only arrived in Washington in 2005. It made sense for him to choose a running mate with Biden's experience. The vice president-elect had served for a dozen years as chairman or ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, traveling widely and meeting many world leaders. Yet Biden could be a frustrating source of counsel. He talked a lot and seemed to revel in the sound of his own voice. "I'm here to listen," he would say to open a meeting, and then he would hold forth for 20 minutes. He was not mean-spirited, but he could be defensive and combative, as Hamid Karzai had discovered the previous January over dinner in Kabul. Because Biden spoke in such an undisciplined fashion and made a display of his vanity, he was also easy to underestimate. Over the decades, he had rejected conventional Washington opinion about some important foreign policy dilemmas, such as whether Iraq could survive as a unified, multi-ethnic state after the Bush administration's invasion. He did not think so. Or the threats of leakage posed by Pakistan's growing nuclear program, which Biden called out well before AQ Khan's smuggling network was revealed. On those issues, he had been lonely and right. Yet his judgment was hardly infallible. He had endorsed George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq. Well before Inauguration Day, Obama asked Biden to investigate the time-sensitive choices he would face about the Afghan war. George W. Bush's final strategy review had passed along a recommendation from the American field commander in Kabul, now General David McKernan, that the United States dispatch 30,000 additional troops to help provide security for the Afghan presidential election scheduled for the summer of 2009. Bush had deferred the general's request so that Obama could decide. The president-elect had said during the campaign that he supported sending at least 7,000 additional American soldiers. The request for 30,000 was a large demand. And Central Command's generals said they needed an answer quickly to deliver the troops to Afghanistan before summer. "What do I need to put into Afghanistan now, so that when the summer arrives, we are not losing ground to the Taliban?" Obama asked Biden privately. Biden flew to Pakistan and Afghanistan. He invited Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator from South Carolina, a vocal supporter of the war in Afghanistan, to come along. It was tempting for Biden to think that the problems the Obama administration would inherit were due in large measure to Bush's coddling of Karzai and Pakistan's generals, and that what was required was greater toughness. In the Senate, during 2008, Biden had co-authored a plan, eventually enacted, to deliver billions of dollars in additional aid to Pakistan's civilian government in an effort to stabilize the country and strengthen civilian rule over the army. He was well acquainted with ISI leaders' long record of unreliability. As vice president, he would be in a position to play enforcer to Obama's statesmen. In Islamabad, on January 9th, he and Graham met Ashfaq Kayani and Ahmed Pasha. Biden told them that he wanted to be sure the U.S. and Pakistan had the same enemy as they moved ahead, meaning the Taliban. "What kind of Afghanistan would represent success for Pakistan?" Biden asked. Kayani assured him that Pakistan and the United States have a convergence of interests in the Afghan war. Kayani's goal was a peaceful, friendly, and stable Afghanistan. I have no desire to control Afghanistan. Anyone who wants to control Afghanistan is ignorant of history, since no one has ever controlled it. That phrase, a peaceful, friendly, and stable Afghanistan, had become Kayani's stock answer to international leaders inquiring about the Pakistan Army's aims amid the Taliban's revival. Kayani thought the phrase conveyed a neutral, cooperative approach that identified shared stability as the main goal. Yet Americans and Afghans heard his search for a friendly Afghanistan as a subtle demand for ISI influence through the Taliban, an interpretation also well-grounded in recent history. Kayani told Biden that there had certainly been some confusion about ISI's pursuit of strategic depth in Afghanistan since the Soviet war. Strategic depth was the phrase a previous army chief had used to describe Pakistan's pursuit of a friendly regime in Kabul. In fact, what it meant, Kayani said, was merely the search for a peaceful neighbor where Afghan Pashtuns were adequately accommodated in Afghan politics. The Taliban are a reality, Kayani also said, using another of his stock phrases. Yet Pakistan did not want to go back to the 1990s or restore the Islamic Emirate in Kabul. The Taliban government of that era had had a negative effect on Pakistan, Kayani said. Biden made clear that the CIA did not trust the ISI and held it partly responsible for the Taliban's resurgence. Pasha said he was hurt by Biden's inference. After his appointment to ISI 3 months earlier, he assured Biden, he had enjoyed a frank talk with CIA Director Michael Hayden, and he had sought the advice of the Islamabad station repeatedly, he added. I'm not going to revisit the past, Biden said. There is no reason for ISI to be protecting these people, meaning the Taliban and its allies, Pasha insisted, and he had no interest in saving them. I need to know the situation has changed, Biden said. He understood that the Pakistan Army had limited capacity, but if the Obama administration provided more aid, would anything really change? It's important to know if we have the same enemy, Biden repeated. In Kabul, Biden met Karzai at the palace and told him the Obama administration would offer a new contract to Afghanistan, but that it would have conditions. Karzai had to address corruption and the opium problem. Biden said these problems could be managed privately, without resort to public criticism or pressure. Karzai should stop publicly calling out the United States over civilian casualties caused by American forces, and the White House would express its concerns about graft and drugs discreetly, too. Mr. President, if you will keep the volume down about civilian casualties, you won't hear about corruption or the drug problem, as Karzai recounted the exchange to aides. Yet the discussion was tense. Biden's insulting theater of the previous year remained in Karzai's mind. Mr. Vice President, we should do more about Pakistan, the sanctuaries, Karzai argued. Mr. President, Pakistan is 50 times more important than Afghanistan for the United States. Karzai received this analysis in stunned silence. Biden also told him, the golden time of the Bush administration is gone. The essence of his message, as Karzai summarized it after the meeting, was, the Taliban is your problem. Al-Qaeda is our problem. No sooner had Biden departed for Washington then Karzai read anonymous quotes in the media, attributed to senior Obama administration officials, that America would expect more from Karzai on corruption. He also heard reports that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had called Afghanistan a narco-state. So much for discretion, it seemed. In private, Karzai now expressed resentment toward Washington continually. He struck his own cabinet as unstable. At an Afghan cabinet meeting on January 17th, some ministers remarked to Karzai that the Afghan people were facing real difficulties. "Are you with me or against me?" Karzai raved. "The U.S. can leave. What they are talking about is unacceptable. I will declare jihad and go to the mountains." The meeting broke up, and the ministers asked one another what had just happened. Several made discreet calls to Washington. Someone should try to talk to Karzai and calm him down. A few days later, an Afghan aide spoke to Karzai for 2.5 hours. The president denied saying that he would go to the mountains, but he complained that the United States is not listening to us. Karzai seemed enormously insecure about how the Obama administration would view him. He was on the eve of seeking re-election as president. His family's security and financial interests were at stake in that election. Improbably enough, Obama seemed to favor Gul Aga Sherzai, his rival, whom Obama had met the previous summer, and who claimed to be invited to his inauguration, according to Karzai's information. Karzai summoned to the palace Kai Eide, a Norwegian diplomat who was the United Nations special representative to Afghanistan. Karzai told him, "They are after the two of us, the Americans. They are after you and I." Several weeks later, back in Washington, Biden invited half a dozen specialists on Afghanistan to dinner at the Naval Observatory residence. He was still ruminating over what the Obama administration should do. The issue he was most qualified to assess, he said, was domestic politics. And he knew one thing for certain. The American people were not going to sustain the Afghan war for very long. They were already weary. "This is not the beginning," he said. "We're already 7 years in." The American economy was collapsing that winter, shedding jobs by the hundreds of thousands. Every morning, President Obama received two dark briefings, one about international threats from the Director of National Intelligence, and a second about the collapsing financial system. 75% of American banks were underwater, Biden remarked. And here come hubristic generals from Central Command with polished stars on their shoulders, demanding the president's signature on a costly troop escalation in Afghanistan, graveyard of empires. Obama's position was like Kennedy's in 1961, Biden thought, when Kennedy was pressed in his first months to endorse a CIA invasion of Cuba. Obama reacted to the pressure coolly and deliberately. "The president," Biden remarked, "has balls like pool cues." Biden instinctively resisted the counterinsurgency doctrine General David Petraeus promoted around Washington that winter. He, too, wondered if using the American military to stabilize Afghanistan made sense when the real problems lay in Pakistan. He leaned back in his chair and asked, at length, "What if the United States poured all the new money it was being asked to direct toward Afghanistan into Pakistan, coupled with a push for regional diplomacy, to include bringing in the Chinese and the Saudis to put pressure on ISI to change course once and for all?" It was a radical notion, certainly unconventional. Of course, Biden's idea would leave the Kabul government to fend for itself, which it could not do. A few weeks later, Obama settled on a seemingly safer course. He cut the Pentagon's request for 30,000 troops to 17,000 and approved sending them forward to try to hold a successful election. On February 13, 2009, in the director's conference room at old headquarters, Steve Kappas swore in Leon Panetta as CIA director. Panetta, like Biden, was a seasoned Washington hand. He had served in Congress for 16 years and another 6 in Bill Clinton's White House, ultimately as chief of staff. He was a charming, profane, first-generation Italian-American who owned a small ranch outside Carmel, California. He had scant experience of intelligence. He barely knew Obama, and considered his appointment to CIA as odd, and not necessarily a great fit. As with all outsiders arriving on the 7th floor, Panetta's first challenge was to establish authority over a permanent CIA workforce that had long ago learned to distrust and outlast political appointees. The task was complicated in his case by the reluctance of his predecessor, Mike Hayden, to leave. Hayden had hoped that his credentials as a nonpartisan career military officer might prompt Obama to leave him in place for a year or so, to oversee a professional transition in CIA operations. But Hayden was an advocate for waterboarding and other enhanced interrogation techniques that Obama intended to end. Hayden had pressured the incoming national security team to reconsider its position on interrogation. It was futile. Obama called Hayden early in the new year and told him, euphemistically, "I don't want to look back," referring to the years of enhanced interrogation techniques. The new White House team wanted only Hayden's departure as a symbolic change. They worked hard to keep Kappus and DeAndrea at the Counterterrorism Center in place. On his third day as president, January 22nd, Obama signed executive orders banning harsh interrogation techniques, which he called torture, to the consternation of many career CIA officers who had convinced themselves over the previous 8 years that they had engaged in no such thing. Obama accepted Hayden's advice on drone operations in Pakistan, however. The next day, while presiding over his first National Security Council meeting, the president approved CIA proposals to continue lethal strikes against al-Qaeda targets under the same rules Bush had approved the previous summer. Hayden remained in charge of the CIA for several weeks as Panetta awaited confirmation. He briefed Obama on targets in Waziristan under active surveillance. 2 CIA drones fired missiles at suspected al-Qaeda operatives that same day, January 23rd, one in South Waziristan and one in North Waziristan. Both attacks reportedly killed civilians. The strike in North Waziristan hit a private home in the village of Zaraki. According to an affidavit from 2 witnesses, the dead included an 8th-grade boy and schoolteachers. The South Waziristan strike killed a pro-government peace negotiator who was a tribal leader and 4 of his family members, entirely in error. When John Brennan, the former CIA leader who had joined the White House as a senior counterterrorism advisor, briefed Obama about the civilian deaths, the president was incredulous, but ordered no immediate changes in CIA procedures. Leon Panetta might not know what a dead drop was, but he knew how to maneuver among Washington's big dogs. He met with Kappus, DeAndrea, and other top agency career officers to assure them that he would have their backs. After 2 lengthy conversations, Panetta asked Kappus to stay on as the CIA's deputy director. When Kappus agreed, his endorsement had influence with other career veterans. Panetta empowered the leadership he inherited at the CIA. He found DeAndrea's Counterterrorism Center to be a very effective, well-run, well-resourced, well-managed unit, an incredibly useful, effective weapon in the effort against al-Qaeda, as a former senior intelligence official put it. For their part, the more sophisticated career officers at the agency recognized that Panetta could deliver on 2 of the 7th floor's essential functions, protecting the CIA at the White House and in Congress. Moreover, the new director was 70 years old. His wife Sylvia had remained at their California ranch, and Panetta intended to commute home as often as possible, which meant that he regularly flew off from Washington for long weekends. He was not going to micromanage CIA field operations. Panetta flew secretly to India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan on his first trip abroad. In India, he heard an earful from research and analysis wing officers and police about ISI's role in Mumbai's carnage the previous November. The RAW officers urged Panetta to pressure ISI to tear down Lashkar-e-Taiba and its branches. In Islamabad, Panetta drove past the Marriott Hotel, bombed and burned the previous September, now reopened. John Bennett, the station chief, and other CIA officers briefed him on the search for Fahid Muhammad Ali Maslam, who went by the nom de guerre Usama al-Kini. He was the suspected organizer of the hotel attack. The briefers inventoried the large number of American dead and wounded. Their message came through clearly. This is an American war. Panetta dined with Pasha and Asif Zardari, Benazir Bhutto's widower, who shared authority uneasily with the army. Zardari made jokes about ISI's pervasive surveillance of him, jokes that sounded paranoid, but were grounded in fact. "Ahmed knows everything I think and everything I say," Zardari remarked of the ISI chief sitting near him. "I walk into my office every morning and say, 'Hello, Ahmed.'" Zardari mentioned that once his presidential plane wasn't airworthy and he had an urgent trip to make. "The only person I could call was ISI, and I said, 'Ahmed, I'm going to ask for your airplane, but only on one condition, which is that you have to fly with me.'" Pasha laughed along, but the scene was awkward. It seemed to the CIA delegation that Zardari might employ a food taster. After Musharraf, the Bush administration had bet on democracy, but with Benazir Bhutto eliminated, they had ended up with a widower of erratic temperament who was seen by few of his countrymen as effective. Zardari did little to reduce his reputation for loose financial dealings when he gave American officials in Islamabad sophisticated advice about buying real estate on the luxurious Upper East Side of Manhattan. "Don't buy in Sutton Place," Zardari advised. "Too far from the action." For his part, Pasha at least offered a voice of moderation that evening, as a participant put it. Throughout western Pakistan, the ISI chief explained to Panetta, "Taliban mullahs have replaced traditional tribal maliks, and a religiosity has taken hold. Tens of thousands of madrasas had sprung up, and young Pakistani men and women were not being properly educated." At the U.S. Embassy, Panetta walked the third floor and addressed the CIA station. He typically carried bottles of high-quality California wine as gifts, which made him seem more charming still. But in a meeting in the secure conference room, Panetta and John Bennett blew up at each other. They were discussing drone operations. The details of their dispute remain unclear, but in essence, a participant recalled, Bennett objected to what he thought were restrictions or constraints being considered at Langley, and he was being a little passive-aggressive. "John, fuck you," Panetta said at one point. "Just get it done." "Fuck you," Bennett replied. Bennett put in his retirement papers and left the CIA that summer. Later, when Panetta needed to find a new chief of the entire clandestine service, he recalled the exchange. Panetta saw himself as a leader who felt an obligation to tell the boss the truth, no matter how uncomfortable. He concluded that Bennett had done the same. He persuaded him to unretire and appointed him to lead CIA espionage operations worldwide. It remained axiomatic that profane men should lead the agency. The essential question facing Panetta in Pakistan was how to assess ISI. He had tried to make sense of Pasha over dinner, but it wasn't easy. Briefings from Bennett and other career officers emphasized both ISI's unreliability and its vital partnership in capturing al-Qaeda leaders like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the architect of September 11th. In Kabul, Panetta met Amrullah Saleh, who had reported to American interlocutors that spring that Saudi Arabia was paying the Pakistan Army directly to supplement American aid and to win influence. Pasha was telling people that he can be rogue, Saleh said, and follow whatever path was best for Pakistan. He was protecting the Quetta Shura from CIA predator operations. The United States had to find a way not to be a cash cow for Pakistan, Saleh emphasized, and it had to end the Pakistani veto over the conduct of the war. To strengthen the Afghan government's position, Karzai should hang criminals and corrupt strongmen to show he was serious, he added. The Taliban were more corrupt than the Afghan government, he said, but they were accessible to the people and had rebuilt their credibility. CIA leaders like Kappus and Langley nonetheless continued to feel that they could not afford to isolate the Pakistan army when it was battling domestic insurgents and cooperating with drone strikes against Al-Qaeda. Gradually, Panetta would come to think that ISI's new boss, Ahmed Pasha, was as good a partner from Pakistan as he was going to find, as a colleague put it. On a Saturday morning that winter, Panetta arrived at the director's conference room to receive Richard Holbrooke. At Hillary Clinton's urging, Obama had appointed Holbrooke as Special Representative for Afghanistan or Pakistan, or SRAP, as the inevitable acronym was usually pronounced. Holbrooke had been Clinton's leading foreign policy advisor during the often bitter campaign against Obama. As a young Foreign Service officer, he had worked in the Mekong Delta and Saigon during the Vietnam War. During the Clinton administration, he led negotiations to end the Bosnian War and served as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He was a man of legendary appetites and ambition, bold and restive, a giant among pygmies, as Sherrod Cooper Coles, his British counterpart on Afghanistan, put it. His grandiosity both charmed and grated. He had hoped to become Secretary of State if Hillary Clinton defeated Obama for president. Instead, he had accepted what he described as the hardest task the Obama administration faced overseas, resolving or at least stabilizing the Afghan conflict. If he succeeded, he might yet become secretary. That Saturday, he wanted the CIA to brief him about the secrets that would shape his chances for success. Steve Kappus joined the meeting, as did analysts and aides. Holbrooke sought Kappus out. "I hear you are the go-to person on Pakistan over here," he said. Kappus chuckled. Flattery was a case officer's tradecraft, and here was Holbrooke trying to practice it on him. Holbrooke took a chair at the middle of the long table. Kappus and Panetta sat across from him. Teams of analysts rotated in to present to Holbrooke. One group briefed him on the status of David Rode, a New York Times reporter who had been kidnapped by the Taliban. During the Balkans War, Bosnian Serbs had kidnapped Rode while the reporter was investigating war crimes, and Holbrooke had negotiated for his freedom. He wanted to do it again. Another CIA team briefed him about the ISI, including what was known and unknown about Directorate S. A third group of analysts briefed about the Afghan army and police. Unsustainably high desertion rates, corruption, and drug use plagued the police especially. Holbrooke asked question after question. Lunch arrived. Holbrooke kept going. Kappus thought Holbrooke was sincere about wanting their insights and advice, but that he was also probing to determine if the CIA would be on his side. The agency was not about to hand over highly compartmented details about which Afghan or Pakistani political and military figures were or had been on the CIA's payroll, and they were not going to be trapped into taking sides in policy arguments with the White House. Holbrooke understood the basic picture. In Afghanistan, the CIA had installed men like Karzai, Sherzai, and the Panjshiris, formerly loyal to Ahmad Shah Massoud, in 2001, and had maintained ties with leading personalities ever since for counterterrorism and political access. Holbrooke argued that the CIA's web of strongmen in Afghanistan, including Ahmed Wali Karzai in Kandahar, was part of the problem in the war. They provided a mirage of security, but governed as predators, exacerbating popular grievances. But Kappes rejected Holbrooke's argument. The United States was at war with Al-Qaeda, the CIA was on the front lines in Afghanistan, and its assets among the country's power brokers were vital. The security of the United States trumped any concerns about the moral qualities of its Afghan interlocutors. Kappes fought tooth and nail, Holbrooke told staff later. Kappes told CIA colleagues that Holbrooke was there to drain the agency's vaults of all its analysis about Afghanistan and Pakistan, dispute the CIA's conclusions, and find the agency's weak points for future interagency policy debates. Holbrooke wanted to end the drone program and make counterterrorism operations against Al-Qaeda more transparent, with a greater role for the military and the FBI, the CIA leaders feared. Holbrooke pressed the CIA for help in bringing Pasha and Amrullah Saleh together in a new cooperative intelligence effort. This would be part of a wider push for cooperation between the Pakistani and Afghan governments, he said. The discussions went on. One CIA official looked at the clock. It was now 4:30 p.m. Kappes's instincts about Holbrooke were mostly right. Holbrooke aimed to shape Obama's priorities through interagency decision-making, and to outflank the CIA and the Pentagon, even as he appeared to embrace them. The CIA leadership's view was that Holbrooke was Holbrooke. He was going to fly around the world and try to make something happen. We didn't know what it was, as a CIA official at the meeting put it. Holbrooke was going to talk to the Russians and talk to the Chinese about Afghanistan and Pakistan. Every other day he was talking to someone else. He was irrepressible. Holbrooke set up his operations in a suite of windowless offices on the ground floor of the State Department. The setting was unglamorous and crowded. There were about 40 staff. Holbrooke's approach was to replicate the interagency process at the National Security Council under his own leadership at State by bringing in liaisons and seconded officials from the Pentagon, Central Command, the FBI, the CIA, and even the Department of Agriculture, which he saw as key to reviving Afghanistan's rural economy. He was building a mini-American government in his own office. Holbrooke's construction of a shadow NSC annoyed staff at the actual NSC. Yet it seemed wiser to get inside his tent than to stand outside. The CIA sent over Frank Archibald, the former Kandahar case officer and Islamabad station chief. Archibald provided Holbrooke continuous access to Langley and also a way for Panetta and Kappes to keep track of what he was doing. Holbrooke also urged NATO governments worldwide to appoint their own special representatives so that he could coordinate global action through them, his own mini-United Nations. British and Australian liaisons moved into his suite. Holbrooke was a terrific subordinate and an exciting boss, but a terrible colleague, a diplomat who worked with him once remarked. He compared diplomacy to jazz improvisation. He riffed at the frenetic tempo of a bebopper. He was often on his BlackBerry and thought nothing of getting up in the middle of a solemn meeting to take a personal call. His behavior struck many of the civil servants around him as arrogant and rude. But Holbrooke seemed to regard self-dramatization as essential to his art. When Holbrooke visited Cooper Coles in London, the British representative arranged a briefing on Afghanistan and Pakistan for him at the Vauxhall Cross headquarters of MI6. Holbrooke agreed only reluctantly because he had theater tickets that evening with George Soros. He stayed for hours, asking questions. At the end, he pulled out several mobile phones, all turned on, in total violation of counterintelligence rules. Pasha flew in to Washington toward the end of winter. He met Holbrooke at the Pakistan Embassy, off Connecticut Avenue, in the ambassador's office. Holbrooke brought a map that he unfolded to go over areas on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. "Don't think this part of the world is like Serbia," the ISI chief advised. "Don't come here with an idea that what you did in the Balkans will work in Pakistan or Afghanistan. They're just not the same kind of places." The Pakistani state looked to be more fragile that winter than at any time since September 11th. Pakistani Taliban insurgents, bolstered by hardened Uzbek volunteers, swept out of Swat and took the district of Bunair to its east, just over 100 miles from Islamabad. They enforced harsh Sharia law. This was the challenge Ashfaq Kayani feared. If the war became about Islamic legitimacy, it might split the country and the army, evolving from insurgency to civil war. By spring, the American and Saudi governments were in full panic about the possible entry of the Taliban into Islamabad. Kayani told Ann Patterson he was desperate for helicopters and had only 5 airworthy Mi-17s to fly. Holbrooke flew secretly to Abu Dhabi to meet Zardari, under cover of a visit to the ruler of the United Arab Emirates, to discuss how the United States might do more. Adel Al-Jubeir, the American-accented foreign policy advisor to Saudi King Abdullah, told Holbrooke that the kingdom, too, was trying to shore up the Pakistan army. "The greatest issue is the collapse of the Pakistani state," Jubeir warned. On March 27, 2009, in room 450 of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building beside the White House, President Obama announced to the public a comprehensive new strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. General David Petraeus, among other advisors, sat before the president in full uniform. "The situation is increasingly perilous," Obama said. He continued, "Many people in the United States, and many in partner countries that have sacrificed so much, have a simple question. What is our purpose in Afghanistan? After so many years, they ask, why do our men and women still fight and die there? And they deserve a straightforward answer. So let me be clear. Al-Qaeda and its allies, the terrorists who planned and supported the 9/11 attacks, are in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Multiple intelligence estimates have warned that Al-Qaeda is actively planning attacks on the United States homeland from its safe haven in Pakistan. And if the Afghan government falls to the Taliban or allows Al-Qaeda to go unchallenged, that country will again be a base for terrorists who want to kill as many of our people as they possibly can. The future of Afghanistan is inextricably linked to the future of its neighbor, Pakistan." A few hours later, one floor below, in a high-ceilinged conference room with parquet floors, Richard Holbrooke joined a private meeting about how President Obama's goals might be achieved. Beside him at a hollow square table sat General Doug Lute, who had led the Bush administration's last war strategy review and had stayed on as the National Security Council senior director for the region. Also at the table sat Bruce Rydell, a former CIA officer who had worked at the agency for almost 3 decades and had also served as a National Security Council staffer during the Clinton administration. Obama's speech that morning had endorsed the findings of what had become known as the Rydell Review, a 15 to 20 page top secret paper defining the new administration's strategy. The paper had a classified annex with sensitive analysis of terrorism in Pakistan, drone strikes, and Pakistan's nuclear weapons. Holbrooke could not sit still. He slumped in his chair and announced that he had to leave early to get home to his wife, the journalist and author Cady Martin. He took several cell phone calls. He mentioned that he had received a call earlier from Hamid Karzai, who was effusive about Obama's speech. Of course, the Afghan president's flattery might just be designed to curry political favor, Holbrook acknowledged. But Karzai had to be forgiven. Under Obama, he had lost his lifeline to the White House, the video conferences he had held with his former best friend, George W. Bush. How often did they do those? Holbrook asked Lute. Often, Lute mumbled. He thought the conferences were valuable. He had seen Bush get a lot done in them over the previous 18 months. But he could tell that the Obama team wanted to send a different message to Karzai. It was a cable station, Rydell added skeptically. The newcomers made no effort to disguise their contempt for Bush's close cultivation of Karzai and the mutual dependency they believed it had created. Holbrook's phone rang again. It's Zardari, he confided. He walked out of the meeting, returned, and said he'd told the Pakistani president that he would call him back. The conversation turned to Obama's dilemmas in managing the Pentagon and Petraeus. This is not 1965, Holbrook pronounced. I would know. I was there. He was referring to President Lyndon B. Johnson's escalation of the Vietnam War based on ad hoc tactical decisions. Instead, Obama had commissioned the Rydell Review to identify vital interests and goals. Yet the Rydell Review they were celebrating was merely a light blueprint, Holbrook acknowledged, not a full-blown military or diplomatic or intelligence plan. He had met Petraeus the night before, he said, to start to operationalize the review's principles. In fact, the review was an unusual, deadline-pressured exercise. It was odd for a new president to commission an outside consultant to study an inherited war. Rydell was a think tank scholar who had advised the Obama campaign, but had no desire to enter the administration. Obama valued him and knew Rydell better than he knew James Jones, the tall former Marine general fluent in French whom Obama had appointed as national security advisor. Jones was not interested in running the Afghan review, he told Obama's aides, because he had to oversee other foreign policy reviews, such as about Iraq. Rydell was a well-informed, direct-speaking analyst, particularly on the subject of Pakistan. He was an ardent ISI skeptic. He wrote well. All of the new team had read Lute's longer, researched, top-secret review from the expiring Bush administration. That document made clear that the war wasn't going well. The general policy direction of escalation in Afghanistan and renewed attention to Pakistan and ISI seemed clear. Rydell offered a convenient solution to Jones's deflection of responsibility. A week after Obama's inauguration, Rydell had chaired a meeting in room 445 of EEOB, the same secure conference room where Lute had run the final Bush review, to announce his study process. "We'll have a draft in a week," he said. That seemed insanely fast. But Obama had declared that he wanted the review finished before he attended his first NATO summit in early April. Another context for the work was that the White House had already defined the big challenge as how to keep Holbrook out of the strategy formation, as a participant put it. This had not to do with policy differences, but reflected a view that he was disruptive and hard to control. The whole thing was weird and awkward and ugly, unsavory, the participant said. Lute and others at the White House were pleased with Rydell's work, but Robert Gates, who had stayed on as Secretary of Defense, thought the draft had no new ideas. The review team sneakily arranged to brief the report to President Obama on a domestic Air Force One flight to Los Angeles when they knew Holbrook would not be present. It was already becoming common for the White House to schedule meetings on Afghanistan on dates they knew Holbrook could not make. The president made no fuss about this maneuver. His staff understood that Holbrook's theatrics put Obama off, and the more contact the two men had, the more alienated the president seemed to become. The Rydell Review mattered because its findings would be distributed as binding presidential guidance to every agency involved in the Afghan war and policy toward Pakistan. Rydell's final draft found that the United States had only one truly vital interest in the region, to defeat al-Qaeda.